Ladies and gentlemen, my name is Howard Burton. I'm Executive Director of Perimeter Institute, and it's a great pleasure to welcome you all here for the penultimate event of our first full day at Einstein Fest, which has, thanks to your participation, been quite a success indeed. It is my great pleasure to introduce Professor John Rigdon, who is giving his second talk of the day, this time on Einstein's revolutionary quantum paper that he came out with in March 1905. Before I list the numerous accomplishments and pedigree of Professor Rigdon, I should say that not only is this his second talk of the day, this is his second of four over the weekend. So in addition to these qualities which I will mention, stamina should be added as well. John Rigdon is the author of the critically acclaimed Einstein 1905, The Standard of Greatness, from Harvard University Press. He's an honorary professor of physics at Washington University in St. Louis. He received his Bachelor of Science from Eastern Nazarene College and his PhD from Johns Hopkins. Upon completion of his graduate work, he was a postdoc at Harvard University. He has served on the faculties of Eastern Nazarene College, Middlebury College, and the University of Missouri-St. Louis. In 1987, he joined the American Institute of Physics, where he served as director of physics programs. His scholarly work has been in the areas of molecular physics, as well as the history of science. His professional activities have been at the national and international levels. He was editor of the American Journal of Physics from 1975 to 1985. In 1992, he was the director of development of the National Science Standards Project at the National Academy of Sciences. In 1995, he was elected chairman of the History of Physics Forum of the American Physical Society. He has served on numerous committees of the American Association of Physics Teachers, the American Physical Society, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, and the National Academy of Sciences. He served as NSF consultant to India in 1968 and 1965, and was the United States representative to the International Science Exhibition in Rangoon, Burma, in 1970, as well as being a Fulbright Fellow to Burma in 71 and to Uruguay in 1975. In addition to Einstein 1905, The Standard of Greatness, John Rigdon is the author of Physics and the Sound of Music, Rabi, Scientist and Citizen, and Hydrogen, the Essential Element. He has edited most of The Good Stuff, Memories of Richard Feynman, as well as several collections, including the Macmillan Encyclopedia of Physics and the Macmillan Encyclopedia of Elementary Particle Physics, where he served as editor-in-chief. Currently, he is co-editor of the scholarly journal Physics in Perspective, and he is a fellow of the American Association for the Advancement of Science and the American Physical Society, and he holds an honorary Doctor of Science degree from Denison University. John has recently been awarded the very prestigious Millikan Award in 2005 by the American Association of Physics Teachers. And one more thing on a personal note, as I mentioned earlier today, for those of you who had the pleasure of hearing John's 10 o'clock lecture this morning, when I was traveling around to various places in North America and in Europe talking to people about the development of what later became Perimeter Institute, John was one of the people whom I had the great pleasure to meet and talk with, and he was very kind and hospitable to me. And during our conversations, he emphasized the importance of outreach activities, and not only the importance culturally, but the importance for a new institute such as ourselves, and what a great opportunity we would have as a new institute to bring our message of joy and wonder of discovery to the population at large. So much of what you see around you, not just at Einstein Fest, but throughout all the outreach programs at the Institute, has in fact been profoundly affected by my encounter with John. Ladies and gentlemen, Professor John Rigdon.
I thank you very much. I find introductions a little embarrassing. I have a question. How many were here this morning? Okay, but quite a few were, and quite a few were not. That means I cannot say the same thing. But it does mean that some of you, the ones that were here this morning, will hear three sentences, maybe four, that you heard this morning. So that's all. Now I want to start with a quiz. Over the years, A number of polls have been taken among physicists. And the question is, name the greatest physicist of all time. Now I'm asking you, and I want someone to speak up and shout out, who do you suppose is number one, two, and three? What? Newton and Albert. That's right. Now, I don't want to diminish your answer, but that's almost a no-brainer. In all of these surveys, Newton and Einstein compete for number one. Sometimes Einstein, sometimes Newton. 1, 2, 2, 1. Now, the challenge comes. Who is number three? Who? Galileo. No. Who? I'm sorry, I don't understand.
Maxwell.
Maxwell. Good choice, no. Max Planck. Max Planck, no. Bohr, no. Who? Schrodinger, no. Who? Feynman. Richard Feynman, no. Heisenberg, no. Oh, you won't guess it. Aristotle, getting warm. Archimedes, bingo. Archimedes is typically often been number three. 3rd century BC, Archimedes was about a millimeter away from Galileo. 2,000 years earlier. It took 2,000 years to walk that millimeter. Archimedes was very close. Archimedes was quite amazing when you put him in 3rd century BC. Now, the moral of that, or a conclusion you can draw from that, is you have Archimedes, 3rd century, you have Newton, 17th century, and you have Einstein, 20th century. These people come along about once every 1,000 years, 800 years, I mean, they don't come along every day. And I think we can say that we are blessed to have lived at a time when we could see the face of Einstein occasionally. He died in 55, so some of you had not the fortune to see him. I never saw him face to face. I never saw him. But he is one of our contemporaries, near contemporaries, and in a real sense, he still is with us. Well, okay. Einstein is number one or number two. Now, we're going to talk about the March paper, but before I do, I will surprise you, I think. There is an artistic, well, a stylistic, and I would say almost an artistic quality to Einstein's papers. His first sentences, of which you will hear one today, and two today, you'll hear two today. His first sentences are revealing and amazing. If you have time, go to the library, get the collected papers of Einstein, and, you know, just look at the first sentences, first or two, sentence or two. They usually put the thing right in perspective, and you know what you know something profound is going to follow. Well, all right, I'm going to show you a first sentence. But this first sentence came in 1935. Now, we're focusing on 1905, 100 years ago. But this one came in 1935, and it was perhaps, well, I will say it was, to my knowledge, or in my judgment, it was the last important paper Einstein wrote. And it departed from the usual. Einstein worked alone, mostly. But in this case, he had two collaborators, Rosen and Podolsky. And this is called Einstein, Rosen, Podolsky, so everywhere it's called the EPR paper. And it turns out, you know, it was ignored for years. Now, the editor of Physical Review tells me that this paper, 1935, I mean, think of that, 70 years have passed. This paper was, in 2003, the most downloaded paper from Physical Review archives. All the papers of the past, this 1935 paper was the one that was downloaded the most. So you see, it's still an interesting paper. Well, I'm going to let you see the words, and I'm going to read them. I hate to do this, by the way. I hate, well, let me go back. Well, it won't go back, so I will do this. Here is something that is also revealing. Einstein's approach to his physics is sort of defined by that statement. What he said was, I want to know how God created the world. I want to know God's thoughts. The rest are details. Now, if you think about that just for a half second, it immediately becomes obvious that if you're concerned about God's thoughts, you don't mess around with trivia. God doesn't think about mundane things. God thinks about important stuff. And Einstein was interested in God's thoughts. I'll have another nice little statement for you tomorrow. But here is the first sentence of his 1935 paper, and it reads, any serious consideration of a physical theory must take into account the distinction between the objective reality, which is independent of the theory, and the physical concepts with which the theory operates. These concepts are intended to correspond with the objective reality, and by means of these concepts, we picture this reality to ourselves. Now, immediately, you know that Einstein was a realist. Einstein believed that your eyeglasses are real, independent of how I think about those eyeglasses, how independent of how I conceptualize those eyeglasses. Those eyeglasses have a reality independent of me. They're real. They're real. And there are things about nature that are real. And it doesn't matter whether I look at them from the right or the left, or if I think of them this way or that way. Independent of me, there's a reality out there, which is the objective of Einstein's work. He always wanted to tap into that reality. And he recognized that that reality had a standing independent of him. So this is the 1935 paper. And by the way, this quote, not a quote, it's his writing, gives you an insight into why Einstein was never able to accept quantum mechanics. Because quantum mechanics is built on a probabilistic foundation, which Einstein could not accept. Well, I'll leave that for now. We're going back to 1905, and I'll read you another first sentence shortly. But in 1905, in a very short time, 6 months, 1 week, 2 days, Einstein wrote 5 papers that shook the foundations and altered the foundations of physics. These papers were in different areas. I'll talk about 1 today, 3 tomorrow, 4 tomorrow. And these papers, which were breaking all the old wineskins, these papers stand solid today. After 100 years of incredible advancement in the subject of physics, new ideas and new theories and so forth, these theories, these papers are still standing firm. So, I will say that The paper we're now going to talk about is March paper, which I find to be very wonderful. Light and Atoms, this is paper number one. Now, this morning, I talked about this a bit. When Einstein appeared on the scene, there were a number of problems. These dishes, and I likened it to a dish of lumpy gravy. Every now and then, you know, your gravy screws up and the flour lumps. And it's not, lumpy gravy is not very good. Well, these dishes were lumpy, and they came into the 20th century lumpy, and leading physicists knew there were problems. And Einstein recognized that there were problems. And these are the dishes that Einstein put on. He took out of these dishes, put helpings on his plate, and he solved these problems. These are the problems he solved. And we're going to talk about those. And today, it is, I say right now, this hour, it is Light and Atoms. And that's paper number one. He finished it on St. Patrick's Day. I don't know if that has any significance. But this was his first paper of 1905. Now, this is the only paper. This is the only dish. The dish up there is Light and Atoms. This is the only dish that other physicists were not interested in. They saw no problem. They weren't thinking about it. Einstein saw a problem. He alone saw a problem. And it led to what he called his revolutionary paper. In fact, he called it a very revolutionary. I'll read that to you in just a minute. Now, what every physicist knew, was that light and atoms interact with each other. Every physicist knew that when light and atoms interact, things happen. For example, here. This is the spectrum of hydrogen. Four lines in the visible. There's a red line, and there's other colors. And this spectrum comes when hydrogen atoms are excited by radiation, and then they give off light of particular frequencies. Every chemical element has a unique spectrum. You can identify any chemical element by the way in which it emits light or absorbs light. Everybody knew this, all right? That wasn't a problem, but nobody saw a problem. Einstein saw a problem. And this March paper addressed that problem and solved it. Now, what was the nature of the problem? Well, 19th century physics closed the chapter on the nature of light. Everyone knew that light consisted of waves, and more than that, light consisted of electromagnetic waves. That was what everyone believed, and that was one of the, perhaps the, crowning achievement of 19th century physics, the electromagnetic theory of light. So that was a closed chapter. Then came Einstein. And he proposed something quite different. Now, just about 2 months after he finished his March paper in May, now he was, remember, he wrote five papers, March, April, May, June, and September. I mean, he was really in overdrive. He himself said, "A storm broke loose in my mind." I think of that. Five papers. Well, in May, halfway through, he had these papers underway. He knew what he was doing, all right? And he wrote to his wonderful friend, Michel Bessel. No, to Conrad Habicht, and he said, "I promise you four papers, March, April, May, June." September was still outside of his thinking. "I promise you four papers, the first of which I might send you as soon as I get the complimentary reprints." You see? May, the March paper had already gone in, all right? The paper deals with radiation. By the way, what is radiation? That's light. Light is radiation. I am being radiated by those floodlights up there. All right? There's other kinds of radiation, same thing. There's radio waves. That's radiation. You hear them on your radio. You tune them in. There are gamma rays. That's radiation. There's ultraviolet. Burns your skin. That's radiation. There's infrared. Makes you feel warm. That's radiation. Visible light, that's radiation. So radiation, all right, what he calls it. Now, let me read it again. This paper deals with radiation, light, and the energy properties of light that is very revolutionary, as you will see. So he sets it out in May to his friend. All right, what makes a paper revolutionary? I will suggest that number one, it contains a big idea. A big idea. Number two, that big idea, if it's revolutionary, number two, that big idea must fly in the face of accepted wisdom. Number three, all of the experts reject it. And number four, if it's going to live to tell the story, it eventually gets drawn into the woodwork of physics. Becomes an integral part of the subject. All right? By these criteria, the March paper is the only revolutionary paper of 1905. In the context of 1905, the June paper on relativity certainly became a revolutionary paper when the full implications of it, but the theory of relativity, elements of that were in the air in 1905. The March paper came out of nothing. I mean, it just came out of Einstein's head. So, big idea, rejected by everyone. Now, let's get to this paper. In this paper, here is the... I don't know what's wrong with this. You see, it keeps going backwards when I want it to go forwards, but I don't know. There is the first sentence. There exists a profound formal difference between the theoretical conceptions physicists have formed about gases and other ponderable bodies and Maxwell's theory of electromagnetic processes in so-called empty space. What is the issue? Ponderable bodies. You know what ponderable bodies are. This is a ponderable body. All right? Now we have, in 1905, we have theoretical conceptions of what matter consists of. For Einstein, and we'll see tomorrow, not for everyone, there were people who did not believe in atoms, 1905. But for Einstein, matter, and for many other physicists, matter consisted of atoms. All right? So here you have atoms on the one hand, and then you have so-called electromagnetic processes in empty space. What's out in empty space? What's in empty space? When you say nothing. Well, not nothing. There's stars up there. We see starlight from every direction. So if nothing else, in empty space, there's light. That light is getting from stars down to Earth. And we see it. We see Orion. We see the Big Dipper. We see stars. All right? So that light is coming to us in so-called empty space. That light is propagating through empty space. It comes down, we see it, all right? So here we have it, ponderable bodies made up of atoms, an empty space filled with electromagnetic radiation, which is light, all right? Waves. Now, what is the distinction here? The fundamental issue is continuity versus discontinuity. Continuity, opposites versus discontinuity. This has been a theme that have themes that have played together against each other all the way through history from the time of the Greeks. And when continuity is in the ascendancy, mathematics dominates, that is geometry. Geometry with its continuous lines. And when discontinuity is in the ascendancy, the algebra of discrete numbers, one. Space, two, space, three, discontinuity between numbers, continuity with lines, all So geometry is very good for continuity, algebra for discontinuity. And that relationship you can see through history. Well, all right, continuity versus discontinuity. Bertrand Russell asked the question, is the world a bucket of molasses or is it a bucket of sand? Got it? Isn't that wonderful? What do you do, I ask? How do you take the world apart? With a teaspoon or a set of tweezers? Spoon by spoon of the molasses, or particle by particle with the tweezers? Profound difference. Is reality fundamentally continuous, or is reality fundamentally discontinuous? Einstein was playing with this idea. Now, at the same time, interestingly enough, many physicists were trying to reconcile the idea of a continuous ether, which we talked a bit about earlier and we'll talk about tomorrow, but the ether was assumed to fill all of the universe. And physicists were attempting to reconcile the continuous ether with the discontinuous description of matter, the atomistic description of matter. But no other physicist connected the same idea, continuity and discontinuity, with light and atoms. All right, now I'll tell you what it's like. Here's a repeated sentence. You all know, because you live near water, but you know, you see the waves come in, and the waves have extension. They're continuous. They all the way down east and all the way down west, you know, whatever the directions are. You see the wave coming toward shore, all right? Now, let me say, if that wave is a big wave, and if that wave hits a boathouse head on, it can destroy the boathouse. But a pebble lying in the sand on the way, that same wave will pass over it and leave the pebble unmolested. Same thing, a wave incident upon an atom, a point particle, the wave can't get at it the way it wants to get at it. It can't do it, all right? So that's the problem. That's what Einstein was dealing with. And how he solved it is the big idea. And this big idea, which is expressed here, reads as follows, and I will read it. According to the assumption to be contemplated here, this is a sentence in the paper, March paper, according to the assumption to be contemplated here, when a light wave is spreading from a point, the energy is not distributed continuously over ever-increasing spaces, but consists of a finite number of energy quanta that are localized in points in space, move without dividing, and can be absorbed or generated only as a whole. Now, you know, you turn on a flashlight, right? And the light leaves the flashlight and spreads out continuously and illuminates that wall continuously, all right? That's the way we think of light. Now, what Einstein is saying is that the energy, and that energy is distributed continuously over that wall where the light hits it. But Einstein is saying, that's not the way it is. He's saying, according to what he is proposing, that light consists of a finite number of quanta particles. That's the big idea. Light consists of particles. Now, that idea absolutely flew in the face existing ideas about light. No one accepted it. No one. And they ridiculed poor Albert Einstein. Well, let me tell you just a little bit how he did it. He did it by drawing upon the framework of thermodynamics, and he used the concept of entropy. Now, entropy is a wonderful concept. The first law of thermodynamics deals with energy. That's the major actor of the first law is energy. The major actor, the star of the second law, is entropy. Entropy, the second law says, in all natural processes, always increases. All right? I'm going to say you know that already, although you never express it that way. Now, Another way came along just at about this time, just a little earlier, by Boltzmann, who connected the second law with probability. And he said that natural processes go from low probability states, situations, to high probability situations. And in that process, low probability to high probability, entropy increases. That's what the second law says. Entropy always increases. Now, you know this, and here's how you know it. Associated with low entropy, low probability is high order. Associated with, what did I say? Yes, I said it right. Associated with low probability is high order. Associated with high probability is disorder. So to say it another way, in the natural world, processes go from order to disorder. All right? Now, again, you absolutely know this. You take your kid's bedroom or your own bedroom, and you know what is the most ordered state of that bedroom. That is when everything in that bedroom has a place and everything is in its place. There's only one way that can be. Everything is in its place. One way. Okay? All right. By contrast, a disordered bedroom is when underpants are here, and socks are there, and shirts are there, and and there's millions of different ways you can throw those things around. There's millions of different ways this bedroom can become disordered. So give it a chance. The bedroom is going to go from an ordered state to a disordered state, and the entropy is going to increase. That happens all through nature. The entropy is always increasing. All right? By the way, this is going to have real traction when we get to the next paper tomorrow. Entropy is always increasing. You understand that now. I mean, you certainly understand bedrooms. Okay? So, one way for a highly ordered bedroom, that is, one way when everything is in its place. That's only one way. Many, many, many different ways you can have a disordered bedroom. So the probability, just in terms of many ways you can achieve this, probability of this is high, the probability of this is low. Okay? So, Einstein worked with that. Now, what he did is just an amazing example of his intuition. This probabilistic approach to thermodynamics from Boltzmann was new, and many physicists did not accept it. And they did not accept it for reasons we'll learn about. But Einstein used it. And what he did was, is he calculated the entropy of two volumes of a gas. And that was a standard calculation. But when he calculated it by the Boltzmann method, the number of atoms comes into the answer. The old-fashioned way before Boltzmann, the number of atoms did not come into it. It was a different expression. Everybody knew it. It was valid. But when you base it on a probabilistic approach, then the number of atoms appears. In the meantime, Einstein had calculated the way light, the entropy of light for two volumes, and it had the identical form as the gas. So there was a real relation between radiation and gas, radiation and particles, continuity and discontinuity. But when he, with no justification, applied the probabilistic approach to a volume of radiation in the same way he had applied it to light, he assumed that the number of particles had to enter. What is the number of particles? Well, light particles. He put the number in. I mean, intuition. He was not driving with a road map. There was no map. he somehow saw that you could think of it in the same way you think of a sample of atoms, and the number of particles of light came into it, and that ended it. 12.5 pages so far of a 17-page paper. The first 12.5 pages developed the particle theory of light. Now, I want to say that this is not the way this paper is usually talked about. In fact, Howard, I'll say it's not even being talked this way about this at this Perimeter Institute. I visited your wonderful exhibits, and I'll tell you what I heard. Let me just tell you what Max Planck said about Einstein's particle theory. I told you everyone rejected it. Well, let me go on with that. Planck said in 1913, the paper was in 1905, so 8 years later, Planck said, Planck was nominating Einstein for membership in the Prussian Academy, highly distinguished stuff, and he had to nominate him and argue for him. And Planck said that sometimes, as for instance in his hypothesis on light quanta, he may have gone overboard in his speculation should not be held against him. 1913. Well, it was more than that. All right. Millikan proved one of the major predictions that Einstein made, which I'll come back to, and in his reporting of this absolute verification of Einstein's prediction, he spoke of, or he refers to, the bold, if not reckless, hypothesis of an electromagnetic light corpuscle, which flies in the face of thoroughly established facts. All right, this was in 1916, 11 years later. Well, it wasn't accepted until 1923, when Arthur Compton did a famous experiment that showed particles of light, particles of radiation, bouncing off electrons, just like billiard balls bounce off each other on a billiard table. You know, they hit and bounce, and it was just absolutely incontrovertible. It was laid out, and you couldn't deny it, 1923. And in 1926, the particle of light got a name. What was it? The what? The photon. And today, the photon is in everything. The photon is the quarterback of quantum electrodynamics, which is probably the most successful theory of 20th century physics. This is a major, this photon is a big time player, all right? Came from the March paper. Now, why is the March paper? Everybody talks about relativity. In some ways, I would argue that the March paper is more significant or as significant, but it's misunderstood. Why is it misunderstood? Well, I'll tell you why it's misunderstood. I told you, first 12.5 pages, Einstein developed the idea, and then in the following 5 pages, he applied it to 3 applications. What he did was, he wanted to show that this idea of light consisting of particles, that this idea had real merit, had heuristic value. And so he applied it to 3 things: Stokes' rule, the photoelectric effect, and ionization by ultraviolet light. 3 examples showed how, when you view light as particles, there's real merit. It explains these things rather well. Okay? The photoelectric effect took 2.5 pages out of a 17-page paper. Now, I'm saying all of this because everyone calls this the photoelectric effect paper and trivializes Einstein's great accomplishment. Trivializes, that's no revolution, the photoelectric effect is a second-order physical phenomenon. It was, nobody doubted anything about it. They didn't understand it all. In fact, there was a problem. But the paper, to call it the photoelectric effect paper, is just an enormous injustice to what Einstein did in this paper. Right out here, demonstrating the photoelectric effect, they're calling this Mars paper the photoelectric effect paper. Everybody calls it that. Physicists call it that. Now I'm going to tell you why. There are two reasons physicists call it that. In the first place, like everybody, often, physicists too, physicists are corrupted by pedagogy. Okay? What happens is, when you learn about this in textbooks, the way this is presented in textbooks and in courses, the photoelectric effect is such a wonderful example of how you can introduce the particle theory of light. So what they do is they lay out all of the stuff about the photoelectric effect. Now, number one, only a very little bit of this was known. The relevant stuff was what Einstein predicted in his paper, and which in 1916 Millikan proved. The real stuff that nobody had known about didn't come until after Einstein's 1905 paper, the relevant stuff. But in the textbooks, they lay it out. All of the data, some known, mostly unknown to Einstein. They lay it all out. There it is. One, two, three facts, all the relevant facts. And then they bring in Einstein with his proposal of a particle for light. And at this point, Einstein looks like a college junior, because almost anybody could take it. Given all of that information, almost anyone could sort of say, look, if we have light as a particle, look what it'll do. But that's not the way it was. Einstein, but that's the way it is in pedagogy. So physicists have learned this way for 50, 60, 70 years. And so a transformation has occurred where the particle theory of light paper has become the photoelectric effect paper, because that's the way they learned it in their textbooks, and that's the way they teach it. It is a injustice. All right. The other factor is that there's history that's misinterpreted. There are many physicists who believe that it was Planck in 1900, who actually discovered the particle of light. That's not true. That's not true at all. In fact, what Planck was doing was trying to understand light emanating from a hot object. And what he did was, in order to understand this, he assigned the oscillators in the object that were radiating this light. He wanted to use Boltzmann's probabilistic approach. He had to. And in order to use that, he had to count. And so he divided the energy of the oscillators into little elements. And from that, he could get the entropy, and he got what he wanted. He did not say anything about light itself. Light itself was continuous, and Planck opposed the idea of particles of light for many years. So we have here, working against poor Einstein's March paper, we have pedagogy, which has distorted everyone's thinking about this paper, and we have historical ignorance about who really did what. And as I say, Planck opposed it for so long, but Einstein had this wonderful result in this March paper. Well, all right, now. So, if you put this all together, you see, for Planck is given credit for being the father of the quantum. Well, maybe okay. But for Planck, it was a mathematical convenience. He didn't believe in it. He did not believe in the reality of quanta. He didn't believe in it. It was strictly, he needed a way to count, And so he divided the energy into little elements so he could count. 3 here, 5 here, 6, you know. Einstein, by contrast, in 1905, this, by the way, Planck was December 12th in 1900 when he delivered his paper before the Berlin Academy. 1905, Einstein proposed a particle of light, and for Einstein, this particle was real. It had physical reality. It was part of nature. It was part of the workings of the natural world. In many ways, I think you could argue persuasively that Einstein, more than Planck, is the father of quantum physics. You can say Planck is the father of the quantum, having divided it that way. But that had nothing to do with physics. Einstein had a lot to do with physics. Well, okay, where does Einstein's particle of light stand today? Well, you know where it stands today. It is, as I've said, it's in the woodwork. So all of my criteria about what makes a revolutionary paper are in fact true with regard to the March paper. Just this year, 2005, Anton Zeilinger. Let me just say, Zeilinger is a prominent physicist, Vienna. There are people who think he's waiting for a Nobel Prize. Oh, let me say something. God, I forgot about it. I said Nobel Prize. Einstein got his prize for the photoelectric effect. Now, do you know why? The Swedish Academy, number one, did not believe in the particle of light. So they wouldn't give it to him for what he did in 1905 March because they rejected it. And by giving it to him for the part, that would have lent credibility to a dumb idea. Okay? By the way, Einstein's Nobel Prize was delayed several years. He was being pushed by the large community because of what he had done, but he was kept being postponed. The pressure was so high in 1921 to give Einstein the prize, and they wouldn't do it, so they gave no prize in 1921. None. Now, the other thing they could have given it to him for was relativity. But the Swedish Academy didn't like the theory of relativity. They didn't like the consequence. They weren't sure they believed it. And so here you had the March paper, particle of light, and here you have relativity, both amazing papers. And in between, you had Brownian motion, which has had a major effect, which we'll talk about tomorrow. So what are they going to do? Well, a new guy came into the Swedish Academy, became a part of the Swedish Academy. And in 1922, they gave none in 1921. Pressure was building. Give Einstein the prize. In 1922, this newcomer adopted a strategy or figured out a strategy, and the strategy was he was going to nominate Bohr, Niels Bohr, and Einstein together. So in such a way that at the Swedish Academy, now Bohr, you know, is from Denmark, and the Swedes are from Sweden. Close, you know. And he set it up in such a way that if the Swedes had rejected Einstein, they'd sort of have to reject Bohr. And they didn't want to reject Bohr. So, okay. They gave Einstein the prize, what do you call it, retroactively for 1921. They hadn't given any in 21. So they gave him the prize for 21, and they gave the prize to Niels Bohr for 22. Now, the Swedish Academy gave him the prize on one condition. You cannot talk in your Nobel lecture about the theory of relativity. Now, what are they going to give it to him for? Well, the photoelectric effect predicted by Einstein in 2 pages of his paper, the photoelectric effect had been verified by Millikan. That was settled. So they gave it to him for the photoelectric effect. A second-rate thing, all right? Nothing like his major ideas. They told him he couldn't talk about relativity. Well, you know, the fickle finger. Einstein was in Japan when the Swedish Academy gave the prizes and all the lectures were given in Stockholm. So Einstein gave his talk a little later, a few months later, a couple months later. And it just happened that the King of Sweden was there, sitting on the front row. And the King of Sweden said, "I want to learn about relativity. I want you to talk about relativity." So Einstein talked about relativity in his Nobel address and ignored the demands, edicts of the Swedish Academy. Well, all right, now back to Anton Zeilinger, who I think and others think could well be winning a prize one of these days. He works in Vienna. Here's what he said. 100 years ago, Albert Einstein introduced the concept of the photon. Now, I would have written that differently, because it wasn't the photon until 1926, but that's a trivial thing, all right? He called it the photon before it was the photon. But 100 years ago, Albert Einstein introduced the concept of the photon. Although in the early years after 1905, the evidence for the quantum nature of light was not compelling, modern experiments, especially the use of photon pairs, have beautifully confirmed its corpuscular character, light's particle character. Research on the quantum properties of light triggered the evolution of the whole field of quantum information processing, which now promises a new technology, such as quantum cryptography and even quantum computers. So Einstein's particle of light is alive and well. Thank you very much.
At this point, we're going
I just want to say one thing. I was going to show this. I don't like slides, frankly. But this is the photoelectric effect. A beam of light comes in, or a ray of light comes in, hits the surface of a metal, and electrons are ejected. That's it. That's the photoelectric. How do you explain that? You know, you have a lot of things you can measure and so forth. But that is the essence of the photoelectric effect, which we talked about. Okay, I'm sorry.
One more and talk about cutoff voltage and all the rest.
Well, you see, what no one knew was that the energy of that electron coming out of the metal was predicted to be by Einstein directly proportional to the frequency of the incoming light. That was a complete new idea after Einstein's paper. That was the relevant idea. The greater the frequency of light, red light is not as energetic as blue light. Blue light is not as energetic as ultraviolet light. So the higher the frequency of the light, the more energy these particles of light. Now remember, think of this. Look at that picture. Think of light coming in as a wave. And this wave comes in and bathes the surface. And this big wave tries to get a hold of a little damn electron. And it can't do it. It can't get that electron out of the metal. But now think of that light as being particle. In comes a particle, bang, hits electron, and out goes electron. If the light particle has enough energy and transfers that energy to the electron, the electron has enough energy to get out of the metal. Just immediately, just like that. The higher the frequency of the incoming light, the greater the energy. The greater the energy of the electron going out. Now, another implication of this is that as you decrease the frequency, remember, the greater the frequency, the greater the energy. As you decrease the frequency, so that the particles have less energy. There comes a certain frequency, a particular frequency, below which you will never see electrons ejected. There's just not enough energy. That's called the cutoff frequency. That was not known. This came out of Einstein's paper, the prediction of a cutoff frequency. So all of this stuff came out of the paper. This is all laid out for students in all of its glory and so forth. Okay, that's enough.
Thank you very much, John. And before we turn to questions, I should also remind everybody here that the very same Anton Zeilinger, whom John was referring to, also gave a talk at last spring's Perimeter Institute lecture series, and you can get that on our website. So never miss the opportunity for a shameless plug. We have people with microphones that will be taking your questions. So if we can, if you have a question, please raise your hand. There's one right here, right in front.
So as you so eloquently said, Einstein used probability, thermodynamics, the whole bit, to come up with these ideas. And then in the 20s and 30s, in the EPR paper, he said, God doesn't play dice. I don't believe in probability in the sense. What's the real explanation between using probability to come up with the ideas and not fundamentally believing in probabilistic basis for the science and
okay.
physics?
Okay, a big difference. Did you hear the question? Why, when he used probabilistic ideas here, and particularly tomorrow morning, he used probabilistic ideas, and he used probabilistic ideas in the derivation of, as I said, you know, to get the number, a number. You can't count parts of a wave, but you can count particles, and so he got that number. Why did he use probability there and not in quantum mechanics? Why did he reject that? There's a fundamental difference between the two. The kind of probability he was using here was a probability of ignorance. If we knew enough, if we had enough details, in principle, we could understand without probability the kinds of systems he was working with there. In other words, let me give an example. You throw a couple dice. You throw dice. Now, there's a certain probability that it'll end up a 6-6. What is the probability? On average, 1 out of 36 throws, you'll get a 6-6. Okay? That's a probability. But now, if we knew exactly how we were going to throw it, and we had the dynamics of the throw exactly, and we knew what kind of a surface these dice were going to hit, and how the surface would interact with those dice, and how the dice were, whether it's perfectly cubes, and, you know, if we had all the information, we could predict. We could see the throw, and we could say, that's going to be a 7, a 4, and a 3. Or we could say, that's a double 1. But you see, we don't have all that information. But in principle, that information is available. We just don't know it. Tough problem. Now, in quantum mechanics, it's a very different thing. The probability is not a matter of ignorance. It's in the woodwork. You can't know. It's impossible to know. The probability is built into things in such a way that you cannot know. And this is when God throws dice. God's playing with us. And Einstein wouldn't accept it. It's not a probability of ignorance. It's a probability of, what should we call it? A probability of the way things are. I mean, this was really the way things are. Very different kinds of probabilities. That was a good question. All right, any other question? I want one more question, darn it. Yes, okay.
Okay, but first...
Now look, sir. I hear badly, so speak loudly.
Okay. First of all, I thank you for your lecture.
You're wonderful.
And for the question, I know he worked hard toward the unified theory of the whole fall forces in our universe. And I wanted to know if he truly believed in God.
Truly believed in that?
Yes.
Absolutely. Absolutely. He was convinced. What he's referring to is, you know, let me just say something. In 1925, Heisenberg created the first version of quantum mechanics, the first time. Quantum theory had a history, but it was all jumbled, and it didn't make any sense. But in 1925, Heisenberg gave us the first version of quantum mechanics, and later that same year, actually early 26, Schrodinger gave us a version of quantum mechanics. And really, in between there, Dirac gave us a third version of quantum mechanics. So we had an abundance of things happening in 1925. From Heisenberg was July. So from July to the end of the year and into the very early time of the 26, the next year, quantum mechanics was developed. Now, Einstein, as we have said, could not accept it because of the philosophical underpinnings. The Copenhagen interpretation, which came out in 27, which made it basically a probabilistic theory, not in the sense of throwing dice, but in the sense that this is the way nature is. Can't get around it. No matter how much you know, this is the way nature is. Einstein could not accept that. Now, the question I'm coming to is, just think, because he could not accept that, well, after 1925, quantum mechanics dominated physics. Everybody got into it. And Einstein was out of the mainstream, on a siding, moving all by himself, and eventually people sort of made jokes about the fact. You know, if Einstein could have accepted quantum mechanics and participated in the development of it, we might have a different quantum mechanics. You know, Richard Feynman said, nobody understands quantum mechanics. Nobody. Now think about that for a minute. Here's this wonderful theory, quantitative, that predicts absolutely accurately experimental results. There hasn't been one prediction that has been shown not to be true. I mean, it's an amazing theory. Nobody understands it. I will just say that says something very, to me, that says something very profound about, number one, why physicists are willing to use a theory that they can't talk about it in words, to explain it to you in words, which makes sense, you know, here's what it all means. They can't do that, all right? Can't do it. Copenhagen interpretation has almost made that impossible. Now, Einstein, so what did Einstein do during all those years? Well, he was very diligently, because he believed it, trying to bring his theory of gravitation, 1916, his greatest single paper, theory of general relativity, trying to bring that together with electromagnetism. And in the same way that electricity and magnetism were brought together as electromagnetism and shown to have a unity, he was trying to bring gravitation and electromagnetism together into one theory, okay? Wonderful. Let me just say one more thing, okay? At this place, right here, the Perimeter Institute, there are high-powered people, prominent people, well-known people, working on quantum gravity. You know what the problem is? The real problem is that here you have gravity, which is understood in terms of continuity. gravitational fields emanate, not emanate, the sun, essentially, and I'm talking not quite in general relativistic terms, but it's all right. But the sun is the origin of a field, a gravitational field, gravitational influence, which the Earth and Mars and Jupiter, they move in their orbits because of this gravitational influence. But it's continuous, right? All of the mathematics of gravitation is continuous. Now you go to the quantum theory of gravity. Quantum theory is discontinuous. It's quanta. And the big challenge, it seems to me, maybe somebody upstairs, God, who knows, maybe they would see it differently, but you know, one of the real problems is trying to bring discontinuity of the quanta, quantizing gravity, together with gravitation. And why do they want to do this? Why? Because there are four fundamental forces in nature that we know of. Everything that happens, happens because of one of these four forces. One is gravitation, keeps your butt on the seat. One is electromagnetism, keeps your arms together and keeps your body together, keeps that chair together, keeps things together. And then there's the weak, what's called the weak force, a dumb title, but it has to do with certain radioactive decay processes. And then there's a strong force which holds nuclei together, these four. Now, I said this is gravity. These three have been shown to have a unity. So we can really see these three in terms of one, in a sense. We can see this as all these three as manifestations of one force, one force. Out here sticks gravitation all by itself. And there's desperate efforts to bring gravitation in so that they can have a unity between all of these four forces. Okay, that's behind it all. Anyways.
That was a perfect time to sum up. I'd like to thank our speaker one more time for a very stimulating.
I'd also like to make three other comments. First, just to emphasize what John said, in fact, this whole issue of continuity versus discreteness is what many people call, in search of a quantum theory of gravity, the holy grail of contemporary physics, and that is really what one of the things which is being pursued here most actively at the Institute from a variety of approaches. And you're welcome to look at the exhibit on the mezzanine to get a sense of that, and we certainly encourage you to do that. The second thing I'd like to mention is that this mystery of quantum theory in and of itself, this notion that John alluded to, that nobody understands quantum theory in and of itself, is also being pursued here at the Institute. And so you can see a direct link behind some of the motivating factors of Albert Einstein and what is still current research being pursued today. And the third point I'd like to make is, notwithstanding what some of you may have in an earlier edition of the program, there is also a talk at 5:30, just to let you know, TV equals MC squared, bringing the joy of scientific discovery to the screen by Evan Haddingham of NOVA. So some of you may have tickets to that. Some, of course, there are other people outside, and there are those who may not have been aware of that and may wish to stay. That starts at 5:30 in roughly 22 minutes. So thank you all very much for coming. And I hope to see you again during the course of the festival. Thank you very much. Upstairs.